You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish, and by Pipefitters Local 533. Since 1983, Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at bktplaw.com to contact us for a free consultation. And Pipefitters Local 533 is a proud and diverse union specializing in many aspects of the piping industry. We're involved with and support various charities, community programs, community organizations, as well as specialized training for our veterans returning home from service. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, exhausted hospital and healthcare workers continue to be in the front lines fighting COVID-19. Join us for healthcare workers and Tim Sheard, a nurse turned mystery novelist, as they attempt to find out what solidarity has to do with defeating COVID. In the news, a union at Google? That's a first. And Casey Tenants vow no eviction January. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. She'll talk about first, OSHA's use of drones may expand in 2021. Second, President-elect Biden will have OSHA address the most dangerous hazards. And third, cold and windy needs appropriate personal protective equipment, especially hand protection. Now for the news.
Google is the first of the five most valuable big tech companies in America to have a union. It's not big yet. It only has 200 of Google's 200,000 workers as members, but it's got big plans. It's called the AWU, the Alphabet Workers Union. Alphabet is Google's parent company. It's part of CWA, the Communication Workers of America. In these times, says after years of isolated issue-based activism by employees, they realized that if they ever wanted a union, the only way to get it was to forge ahead. Chewy Shaw, a software engineer and vice chair of the new union, said he joined Google in 2013 because he believed in the values, but he soured on the company because it pushed out dissident workers and because of its contracts with government agencies like ICE and police, as well as accusations of sexual harassment and racism. The turning point for many was the firing last month of Timnit Gebru, who had criticized Google. The AWU's structure could be a model for future tech organizing, It will be a dues-supported organization, like a union, but it will be open to both full-time employees and contractors who make up more than half of Google's workforce. The members hope that the rush of publicity will bring in thousands of more members in short order. The AWU will not be able to engage in formal collective bargaining like a union that represents the entire staff, but it will be a permanent, growing, and very vocal labor group positioned squarely inside one of the world's most powerful companies, something that would have been virtually impossible if CWA had tried to follow a traditional union organizing route within Google.
After Kansas Senator Jerry Moran announced that he would not challenge the votes of the Electoral College for Biden and Harris, he was greeted with howls of disapproval from other Kansas Republicans. Indeed, Mark Geitzen, president of the Kansas Republican Assembly, demanded that Moran resign, stating that there was irrefutable evidence that Biden operatives in every state had conspired to steal the election from Trump. Meanwhile, the other Kansas senator, the just-sworn-in Roger Marshall, stuck with Missouri's Harvard and Stanford-educated constitutional scholar Josh Hawley in backing the Trump-attempted coup and failure to criticize the violent assault of MAGA-swaddled warriors on the U.S. Capitol, scaling walls, invading the chambers, and rousting their elected representatives from their seats. Luckily, some precocious aide thought to grab the box with the electoral votes in them, thus preventing the MAGA warriors from destroying the results of voting of millions of Americans. One widely circulating cartoon showing them scaling a wall surrounding the Capitol quipped that the MAGA crowd proving to themselves that walls don't work. This morning, a Kansas City Star editorial stated, "No one other than President Donald Trump himself is more responsible for Wednesday's coup attempt at the U.S. Capitol than one Joshua David Hawley, the 41-year-old junior senator from Missouri, who put out a fundraising appeal while the siege was underway. Hawley, they said, has blood on his hands." Several unions are calling for Trump to be removed using the 25th Amendment to the Constitution to do the job. The North American Building Trades Union's President Sean McGarvey called the events despicable and demanded Trump immediately step down or be removed. He also called for the resignations of Senators Hawley and Ted Cruz, along with the other members of Congress who objected to the Electoral College count.
Who are those largely white male thugs for MAGA in the assault yesterday? They have been described as working class. But is that really who voted for Trump? According to FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, whose program Counterspin airs Tuesday at 6:30 here on KKFI, exit polls complicated a favorite trope of campaign coverage, Trump's white working class base. While it's true that Trump did 15% better among white voters without college degrees than with them, but not having a college degree doesn't make you working class among three-fourths of voters whose households make less than $100,000 a year. Trump trailed badly. Biden had a 15% lead, 57 to 42. Among those who make less than $50,000, and Biden was ahead 13%, 56 to 43, in the $50,000 to $99,000 group. Among the wealthiest quarter of the electorate, Trump did have a lead, winning 54 to 43 over Biden, of households making more than $100,000.
Eviction hearings resumed today in Jackson County, and KC Tenants were there to stop them. As about 60 members of KC Tenants rallied this morning at the courthouse, other members were disrupting the online hearings aimed at evicting the poor and sending them to live in cars, homeless camps, and motels. At the rally, organizers read statements by a number of tenants facing eviction who couldn't be there because they were working. The fact is, contrary to what many believe, people facing eviction are working people. They simply don't earn enough to keep their landlords off their backs. Many have had their hours cut, lost jobs, and had to take whatever they could find. As speaker after speaker made clear, evictions in the middle of a pandemic just ain't right. According to KC Tenants, there is a national moratorium on evictions because of the pandemic. But despite that, Jackson County courts are aiding landlords in evicting people. The court has heard over 2,000 evictions since June and has issued over 778 eviction judgments against tenants as of December 23rd. The Jackson County Court has scheduled over 700 eviction hearings just this month in January. Casey Tenants has responded by protecting tenants, delaying over 365 evictions through court disruptions, and distributing over 10,000 flyers to tenants on their rights and available protections under the CDC eviction moratorium. Just yesterday, Casey Tenants delayed 103 evictions in eastern Jackson County. Casey Tenants say that evictions are death sentences, and they're planning to engage in direct action all month for a zero eviction January. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Tom Gepkin, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Praise be the nurses and doctors, every medical staff bent over flesh to offer care, for lives saved and lives lost, for showing up either way. Praise for the farmers tilling soil, planting seeds so food can grow, an act of hope if ever there was. Praise be the janitors and garbage collectors, the grocery store clerks and the truck drivers barreling through long, quiet nights. Give thanks for bus drivers, delivery persons, postal workers, and all those keeping an eye on water, gas, and electricity. Blessings on our leaders making hard choices for the common good, offering words of assurance. Celebrate the scientists working a way to understand the thing that plagues us, to find an antidote, and all the medicine makers. Praise be the journalists keeping us informed. Praise be the teachers, finding new ways to educate children from afar, and blessings on parents holding it together for them. Blessed are the elderly and those with weakened immune systems, all those who worry for their health. Praise for those who stay at home to protect them. Blessed are the domestic violence victims on lockdown with abusers, the homeless, and refugees. Praise for the artists and poets, the singers and storytellers, all those who nourish with words and sound and color. Blessed are the ministers and therapists of every kind, bringing words of comfort. Blessed are the ones whose jobs are lost, who have no savings, who feel fear of the unknown gnawing. Blessed are those in grief, especially who mourn alone. Blessed are those who have passed into the great night. Praise for police and firefighters, paramedics, and all who work.
Happy New Year to everyone from the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Chris Mann, and I will be the host for this evening. The song you've just heard was Pandemic Praise by Christine Paintner. According to the news accounts, yesterday, while proudly unmasked crowds were breaking windows and scaling DC Capitol buildings in defense of charlatan politicians, 4,000 Americans took their last breath as a result of COVID-19. On that same day, in hospitals across the country, hundreds of healthcare workers struggled to keep the 4,000 people alive. And then, when their efforts failed, struggled to deal with the sadness and the trauma of seeing mass death. Tonight, we want to speak with these hospital workers and hear their fear and get a sense of what they need to keep our population healthy and to keep themselves healthy. Our guests tonight are Ralph Stovall. He has worked at Truman Medical Center at the Hill as a floor tech for 8 years. He's been a member of Service Employees International Union for the same amount of time. His job does not put him directly in contact with patients. He's a former sheet metal worker where he was active as a union steward. He has served on the Truman Hospital Bargaining Committee. Shirley Kasten is a gastroenterologist tech. at Research Hospital, and she's been at the facility for 35 years. She's a steward and has served on various bargaining committees there and has worked on all the contracts they've had. She believes that the power comes from numbers and that the union is their source for power. Kayla Mitchell is an RN nurse from Oregon who traveled to New York City to help with the pandemic during that critical time. Tim Sheard is a retired nurse and union organizer with the National Writers Union, United Auto Workers, Local 1981. He has edited the popular book, A Pandemic Nurse's Story, which is a collaboration between Nurse T, a real-life ICU nurse who has been on the front line since the beginning of the pandemic. The stories of Nurse T and others have had such an impact on Tim that he started a band called The Pandemics and learned to play the guitar and wrote music, some of which we'll hear tonight. So I'd like to start by having our guest just tell a little bit about the job you do in the hospital. So we can start maybe with Shirley, since that was the longest name I had to pronounce, the longest word.
Hi, everyone. Happy New Year to everyone. So my job is, it's on your feet 8 to 12 hours a day. Most of my patients that come in are supposed to be pre-tested for COVID, and they're supposed to quarantine for the amount of time that they have been tested, but nothing says that they stay quarantined. So, gastroenterologist is doing colonoscopies and things like that. So, and we do a lot of other things beside routine procedures. And so we worry. We have to do inpatient COVID patients and things like that. And so it's new to all of us. And so, you know, you worry when you go in the room, when you come out, did you forget to do something that you should have done? Because this is not something that you do every single day. So you want to make sure that you follow all the steps and protocols that you are supposed to follow so that you don't take anything away that from that room that you shouldn't. And so it's stressful. It's stressful for all the workers in the hospital. It's stressful for the EVS workers when they go in sometimes to clean a room. They wonder if they have the proper equipment, you know, on when they go in and clean the room, or they may go in and clean a room and didn't know it was a COVID patient's room because there wasn't a sign on the door. And so they didn't know to afterwards. So I think it's stressful for everyone, no matter where you work in the hospital, what your job may be. I just think it's very stressful, because no one wants to bring something home to their loved ones and things like that. And so, yeah, I think it's very stressful.
Thank you. And Kayla?
Hi.
Hi. So, thank you for coming on all the way from Oregon.
Oh, thank you. So I work at an outpatient surgical clinic. So we do pain management, kind of the same as the endoscopy clinic would. Our patients are all ambulatory. They're supposed to be attesting that they're not around COVID positive patients, but we still have seen a lot of people come up positive patients, staff. I mean, it's really hard, I agree, because, you know, to kind of mimic what Shirley said, you know, patients do what they want, staff does what they want. It's not really up to us to control things. And I think there's a lot of different data out being published constantly. And so you never know what the right answer is. And you just want to take care of your patients and do right by them. And, you know, you worry, am I being too complacent? Am I doing everything right? Am I going through the right steps? And all day you're just trying to do the right thing for your patients and also for yourself, because you don't want to take something home to your family. And you don't know what you've been exposed to, so you don't want to go out into the world and expose a bunch of other people. So, you know, we're all very isolated too, on top of, you know, working our jobs.
Okay. And Ralph, can you describe your job in the hospital? Okay, while we're waiting, Tim, you worked in the hospital for 40 years. What did you do besides everything, probably?
Thank you. Well, I spent most of my time working in intensive care units, medical, cardiac, intensive care. And I spent my last 12 years working with infection control and epidemiology. So we were concerned with outbreaks. So when COVID hit, although I'm retired, I'm in touch with people in the public health sector and epidemiology. So it's enabled me to kind of keep close to the ground for the outbreak.
Okay. And Ralph, are we able to hear you now?
I got it to come up. Unmute.
Okay, that's good. Now we can hear.
You hear me now?
Yeah, Ralph. Yes.
Go ahead. Okay. Well, I'm Ralph Stovall, and I work at Truman Medical Center. My job consists of floor work. I don't have the opportunity to actually work with patients or going in and out of the rooms. So I have to focus on just taking care of the floors in the in each building that we have to cover. We strip and wax floors and do carpet work, stuff like that. So I don't really get the opportunity to, like I said, work hands-on with patients. I just work with my coworkers, the EVS workers, what some of their complaints are, and kind of piggyback on some of the things that Shirley said, that I hear the same from them also, far as being stressed out, overworked, understaffed. Rudy patients treat them bad, talk bad to them. They're putting two COVID patients in one room, then they're asking our individuals to go in the rooms to do a terminal clean after one may get discharged, but still there's another patient in there. So I really can't respond on too much on the COVID side of things, but like I say, my job consists of doing floor work.
And I think later in our conversation, from reading one of Tim's books, it's One Foot in the Grave so far. I'm not finished with it yet. Through his characters, he says how important cleaning horizontal surfaces are and how important floor work is. So thank you for doing a good job at that and speaking up about it. So now, can the following questions, you don't really have to, I'm not going to call on everybody. Everybody feel free to jump in or indicate by just giving a little signal. You can answer the question if you want to. You don't have to answer every question if you don't feel that you want to, but do you have adequate supplies to do your job well? What was it like prior to the pandemic? Did you have adequate supplies to do your jobs well? And do you have them now?
I'll jump in. Pre-pandemic, everything was a one-time use. You kept everything you needed in your own department. After the pandemic came, now we have to go to the PPE room and we have to check out what we need. And if they determine this is not the adequate equipment we need for where we're working, then we don't get that. So like, for example, when the pandemic first came and the EVS workers went to clean rooms, they just went with a level 3 mask. They had no shoe covers, they had no goggles, they had none of those things, you know. They just put a plastic gown on, and they went in and they cleaned the room. That's what they did. And so as time went on, things changed. Then they had to, everybody in the hospital had to wear goggles and things like that. So it's just like I said before, the concern that you have for people, because I feel like nobody really knows the extent of this disease, and they don't know exactly how you can catch it. I mean, I don't think nobody's really sure about that. And so why not give people what they need, so without a doubt, you protecting them to the fullest, and so it decreases their chances less of getting anything, because, you know, you protect them as much as you can. And, you know, I just felt like they didn't get that at first. I felt like that didn't come till later on, and I didn't think that was right. And so, like I said, everything used to be a one-time use. Now it's not.
Kayla, did you?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Shirley. You know, prior to COVID, I don't even think that our PPE was the best sometimes. You know, I've gone into patients' rooms that have infectious diseases before COVID was even a word that we said regularly. And I feel like we've sometimes had substandard PPE as a normal, as a standard. And, you know, we're going into these rooms, we're taking care of these patients, we're doing a lot of cares where we're exposed to bodily fluids that can contaminate us. And, you know, we just have this really thin layer on the front of us, and our sides, our bottom of our legs, our backs are all exposed. We're in there doing wound vac changes. We're doing, you know, emptying urinals, we're cleaning them, we're bathing them, we're helping. And then, you know, you take off this thin little layer of, you know, it's like this, it's not even cloth. It's like this weird little mesh garment thing. And then you take this off and you go into the next patient's room. And so it's really, I mean, you obviously like wash up and stuff in between, but, you know, I'm wearing my same scrubs. I'm doing a lot of cares where I'm highly exposed. And I think a lot of times, you know, the concern for me is, you know, I'm pretty young, I'm pretty healthy, I'll probably be okay if I catch something. But it's scary when you go into people's rooms and you don't know what you're exposing them to. And then you apply that to COVID, you know, here we are with our kind of janky gear, and we're heading into these rooms, we're doing all these cares. In New York, we did everything for the patients. We didn't hardly have housekeepers come in. We were lucky if we had a tech for the whole floor. So we were doing everything for our patients, cleaning the rooms, taking care of the patients in these flimsy little gowns and whatever PPE we got. And then, you know, you go to the next room, and it's just kind of scary because you don't know what you're exposing other people to. You know, is this a different strain? Is it the same? Is it truly COVID? I don't know, but now I've potentially contaminated all the patients I've been assigned to tonight and every shift, because that's just the nature of being a nurse, is I can't not go into that room and not care for my patients. But, you know, the infection spreads really rapidly because you don't know what you're exposed to. And I think sometimes people don't quite understand that, you know, infection spreads really quickly because before you have symptoms, you're going home to your family. Some people live in multi-generation homes, and so they have more vulnerable people in their home. They're exposing them to things before they even realize that they potentially have a symptom. And by the time they're testing positive for a contagious disease, you know, they've already exposed their whole family, any of their friends, any of their patients they've come in contact with. You know, it's scary how quickly infections can spread. And so sometimes I think that there's not quite that knowledge out there. And our PPE sometimes leaves a lot to be desired.
And in the character Nurse T in the Nurses Pandemic story, Nurse T was asking questions of doctors and hospital administrators way before the virus was a problem in the United States. She was on top of that, but the docs seemed to think that the American healthcare system would take care of that easily, and were not concerned about it at all. Do you feel that that would be about American exceptionalism, that in America we're too good compared to the rest of the world, that this something like this won't happen? Or do we point to politicians like Trump and his cabinet who virtually let people just contract the disease? What do you all think? In a minute here, we're going to go to break, and I'd like you to be introduced to Nurse T through Tim's song about Nurse T, and it describes her as being very patient and a very good nurse in spite of the fear of COVID. So does anybody want to tackle that before we go? Do you feel we're in the spot we're in because of people just don't believe that Americans can fail this much? Or is it leadership, a question of leadership, or is it both?
I think it's both. I think that first it started at the top with the leadership. And I think that Trump should have told us when he knew that the virus was here, that it was deadly, that it was dangerous. And I think that he should have told people to wear a mask and social distance, because I think people would have listened to him. Instead of telling people this is all a hoax and it's just to destroy me. And, you know, I just think people listen to him. And I think that had he been honest with the public and told the public what we need to do, and had we hunkered down the first 6 or 7 months, I don't think we would be as bad as we are. I think we will be coming towards the end of this with the vaccine. I think that people would feel more comfortable with taking the vaccine. I think that we would see things totally different had he came out and been honest with, I know I would feel differently had he came out and just been honest about the situation. You know, I mean, it, like he said, it is what it is. So we have to protect ourselves. We have to protect our family. And so, yeah, I think leadership, I think it starts with the leadership.
Okay, Kayla, you want to get a last comment in here before we go to break? And we're going to hear an excerpt from the pandemic's recording about Nurse T. And then we'll take a couple of promos that the station has to do, and we'll be back after Kayla gives a short comment.
Sure. Yeah, I was just going to say kind of the same thing. I think, you know, it's always leadership. We look to leaders. We want to know what they're doing, what they expect of us. We want a standard. We want a clear guideline. I think it would have been helpful had he, you know, our leadership in general, worn masks, said, protect yourselves, do this. I agree people would have listened. But I also do think people put a lot of faith in our healthcare system and say, oh, we'll be fine. We can deal with this. And I think that people don't realize that, you know, it's on top of the normal caseload of the hospital. It's not like a normal day at work. It's like you already have a full caseload. And now here's this onslaught that's just not stopping. So I just think it was a really rough situation for everyone in general. And you know, it'll take a long time to rebuild, but it was definitely insight into where we can improve and rebuild.
Okay, and before we go to break, everybody think about what's wrong with our healthcare system. What did this pandemic show us? And we'll go to break now.
Nurse T starts her day with a prayer she'll be okay. Leaves the hotel room and stands outside the door. She meets with her best friend and asks, when will the nightmare end? So many dead, my Lord, how many more? There's a heart that's full of love.
if we don't look back at 2020 now, we may never do it at all. Here are just a few things we accomplished this year, thanks to you. We shared over 60 local artists and organizations through the live stream booth. Crossroads Music Fest and Mixmaster Music Conference went virtual, and were able to expand the reach and a number of people that were aware of it. And the Unbanned Auction, where we just played local artists all weekend long, I say we keep that one. We began sending out the Mid-Coastal newsletter monthly. We were able to increase our staff. We got the KKFI Prize Closet up and running. Our community podcast platform is now hosting 18 community podcasts. We increased the local election coverage from our news and public affairs programs. And we're able to do all of this because you care enough to support KKFI, either with your donations or by volunteering your time. I've said it many times, and I will say it again. KKFI is the people. You are KKFI. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Okay, we're back with hospital workers during the pandemic. And before break, we were thinking about what has the pandemic shown us that's wrong with the healthcare system? Who's being hurt by this, by the pandemic most?
Well, I think this, who's being hurt the most are the patients, the ones who's actually catching the virus. Then secondly, the staff of each hospital, the doctors and nurses, and also the housekeepers, the food service workers. This has exposed the weakness and not being prepared for something like this. But like once again, it all did start from the top. If we had opportunity to have individuals at the top who was more humble and focused on staying on top of things like President Obama did, he had a department that was already set up to just focus on diseases of the world. And President Obama canceled all that out. So when China, whatever happened over in China, and President Trump found out about it, he just never did let nobody know, because he didn't want nobody to panic. He just didn't know what to do. So the man really didn't care. So now we done lost thousands of people. So I think mostly the patients.
And nurse, go ahead, whoever was speaking. Go ahead, Shirley.
I was going to say, I thought it showed the disparity among communities. That's what I think it really showed. The disparity in healthcare, something that we have known for years, but I thought that's what it really showed to me. It affected the Black and Brown community the worst. They were the people who had the most pre-existing conditions. And so they were the most impacted by this. And so I think that's what it really showed. And that, you know, the vets, the homeless, and you know, the people who served our country, who can't get the health care that they need. And, you know, yeah, I think it showed all of that.
Could I add, Christina?
Absolutely.
In New York City and New York State, but in New York City where I am, the last several administrations have been closing hospitals and clinics, claiming that we can't afford to keep them open. And at the same time, Wall Street and the people who make money off Wall Street have increased their wealth to the point that it's beyond our imagination. This fellow Bezos is coming up to have a personal wealth of $1 trillion. And yet the state is unwilling to tax Wall Street at all and put that money into rebuilding our healthcare. So as Shirley said, it's inequality, and it's become so large and so severe and so unjust that we really have to bring in a whole new slate of political leadership, and we have to tax the people who are stealing our wealth. They're stealing our wealth because they're not paying fair wages. They're busting unions, and we need to fix that. We need to build a union movement, really, if we want income equality.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay, I'd like to hop over to talk about two things, ventilation and sanitation in the hospital. Tim, with his background, I stumbled on his website, hardballpress.com, that he invented a thing to make the hospital rooms negative pressure with fans from Home Depot. Tim, can you tell us about that and clarify how important is ventilation, number one, with the pandemic, and other people can chime in here. And then what's the difference between using a HEPA filter and a negative pressure room?
Sure. Well, as Kayla and Shirley will tell you, when you're working in a room with a patient, especially if you're doing any kind of procedure, you're at the risk that the patient is going to release virus into the air in tiny droplets. And when you have someone in a small room, like in an ICU room or a procedure room, the air is filled with droplets. And when you open the door, it all blows out into the hallway or into the next room. So in an intensive care unit, for example, the people who work in the unit are exposed every time you open the door from the room. Or if you're working in a clinic, people in the clinic are exposed. With a negative pressure, all it is a fan in a window blowing air out into the environment where it's dissipated and made harmless. So when you open the door, the wind blows in. The air actually blows into the room, and we don't get what are called COVID bombs of releasing droplets into the ICU or into the rest of the clinic. And years ago, when we had an earlier outbreak with H1N1 with the bed influenza, we talked in our hospital about putting simple fans from Home Depot into the windows of the patient rooms, because we didn't have the ability to make true, you know, professional grade negative pressure rooms. And we talked about it, but we could never convince the administration to allow us to do it. But it definitely works, because it's just a fan. A HEPA filter is a filter like the filter in the dryer when you dry your clothes. And we know that it collects lint and it becomes clogged and it stops to work. And when you're in a crisis pandemic and everybody's working so hard and they're overworked and under-resourced, you know they're not changing the filters on a regular basis. So you know they're going to lose their efficiency. They're not going to be doing their job and nearly as well as a negative pressure. Negative pressure is really the best way to keep people safe from the virus.
Okay, and has that been implemented anywhere? I know in Nurse T's book, she talks about the nurses are worried every time the door opens because they're getting the droplets from the air.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
Well, that was one of the things, we're in the middle of bargaining, and so that was one of the things that we wanted to put into our contract was to try to do something with the air in the rooms and stuff, and you know, to try to change the ducts and things to make the air more sufficient for people who are working and for the patients and stuff, but they rejected that. So but that was one of the things that we was looking at putting into the contract to protect the workers and the patients.
I think everybody kind of touched on this,
but
everything comes down to costs, and healthcare's run as an industry where, you know, we're making money. It's a capitalist industry. And so it's really hard because everything comes down to cost. And, you know, clinics and hospitals, they're trying to pay their overhead and pay their employees and pay this and pay that. And everything comes down to dollars and cents. And even something that's, you know, $2-3, once you put that into a bigger scale of you need that in every single room, all right, whether you have 20 rooms or 100, it's going to add up, and everything comes back to cost. And so it's really hard sometimes, because I do think our healthcare system is run so much for profit that it really is our patients and our staff that suffer from the top to the bottom. And you know, it's not just the frontline workers that are being exposed. It's everybody. It's everybody that walks in that hospital. It's every patient. It's every family member. Mm-hmm. It's everyone. And so it's really hard because, you know, people really need to make an investment into healthcare, and no one's really making that a priority. They haven't in the past. They're making profits where they can and cutting corners where they can. And it's really come out into broad daylight all of a sudden that that's what this is. It all comes back to dollars and cents.
Okay, and I want to, we have less than 5 minutes left, but I want to touch on really quickly sanitation, because in one of Tim's books, One Foot in the Grave, a doctor is leading a group of people, interns and other doctors, from room to room, and he says that the most effective preventive strategy is to continually clean horizontal surfaces. And he says, and why is that? When a patient sneezes or coughs or talks, they release clouds of droplets, and the droplets fall on the horizontal surfaces. I just know from being a teacher in a classroom that I have learned so much from our school custodian and maintenance workers about the atmosphere in a room and the cleanliness, how important it is. So I just want to say, I don't think we can discount that at all. That is just as important as what the doctor does, according to this doctor. Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to give everybody a chance at the end here to just say what you would like the general public to know about your about the situation for healthcare workers now, and what you would like them to do. And we have I've been giving 1 minute, so if we could do it quickly.
I would encourage everyone to stay home and mask up and protect yourself and the community. That would help the healthcare workers.
I would say that we need to encourage, we need to push our legislators to increase Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. The reimbursement rates are so low that clinics and hospitals that serve the poor, they just aren't funded. They can't provide. So we really need to increase our spending rates for Medicare and Medicaid.
I think the community needs to be educated a little bit more on this COVID virus, especially about this the vaccine that they're giving out right now. So I think they need to give them more information about that.
Okay. As we, the public, now have gotten a glimpse into the American health factories, which are known as hospitals, our duty then is to recognize the healthcare workers, that healthcare workers need support, rest, adequate pay, trauma care, and respect. So thank you all for being on the show tonight. I feel like we just touched the surface, however. So I wanted to thank everybody again for being on the show. And our next event on the Heartland Labor Forum is a feature called Safety First with Mary Aereo.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Aereo for Safety First. First, OSHA's use of drones may expand in 2021. From www.ehstoday.com for January 4th. On December 28th, the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, announced a final rule allowing operators to fly small drones over people under certain circumstances. According to attorneys for the Seyfarth Shaw Law Firm, the new rule could lead to lead the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, to push for the increased use of drones at worksite inspections. OSHA inspections must adhere to what is called the plain sight rule. That means anything the compliance officer lawfully observes during the inspection can be the basis of a citation. As you might well expect, the scope of what is in plain sight expands considerably when drones are used by inspectors. Agency policy also bans compliance officers from exposing themselves to hazards during inspections, which, for example, often means limiting their ability to climb ladders and otherwise observe conditions on towers or hard-to-reach places. In recent years, OSHA has sought to get around those limitations by photographing and videoing work sites with airborne drones, also called Unmanned Aircraft Systems, UAS. OSHA's enforcement policy concerning the use of OAS currently requires the agency's inspectors to obtain express consent from the employer prior to using a drone, the attorneys note. Because the FAA's new rule expands circumstances under which drones can operate without a waiver or exemption, it could open the door for OSHA to change its policy and use drones more freely at work sites without employer consent if OSHA can deploy equipment complying with the new criteria. Next, President-elect Biden states that OSHA to address the most dangerous hazards from www.ishn.com for January 5th. President-elect Joe Biden issued a 324-word statement on December 29th and in summary stated, 50 years ago today, President Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act to assure safe and healthy working conditions for workers across the country. For 5 decades, the hardworking civil servants at OSHA have fought to uphold that mission and protect worker lives. And yet today, in the midst of a global pandemic, OSHA has been prevented from using its full range of tools to protect workers from COVID-19. The number of OSHA inspectors is at its lowest since 1975, while millions of essential workers are working to keep the country functioning through the pandemic. As they risk their lives to save others in this pandemic, they should not have to lie awake at night wondering if they'll make it home from work safely the next day or if they'll bring home the virus to their loved ones. Biden continues, my administration will ask OSHA to determine whether to establish an emergency temporary standard to keep workers safe from COVID-19. I will direct OSHA to enforce worker safety requirements, target the worst violators, and work to increase the number of OSHA inspectors to get the job done. And I will direct OSHA and other relevant agencies to develop comprehensive strategies for addressing the most dangerous hazards workers encounter in the workplace. Biden ends with, as president, I will work every day to uphold the mission of OSHA established 50 years ago and protect the safety and well-being of American workers. Finally, cold and windy needs appropriate personal protective equipment, especially hand protection, from www.ohsonline for December 1st. Keeping warm is a basic need that all of us share. For those who work in cold temperatures, the need to keep your hands warm and protected is a major concern. The National Weather Service website at www.weather.gov has a box in the upper left corner where you can put the city or zip code to get your local weather. Once you have the temperature and wind speed, the NWS also has a handy wind chill chart. At the website, under safety, look up winter weather. Wearing the proper PPE is one of the primary preventive measures to protect workers in cold environments. Winter work gloves, which are critical to performing tasks, play a critical role in preventing cold stress, including frostbite and hypothermia. When specifying a winter glove for your safety program, make sure it has a water-repellent or waterproof outer coating or material that provides water resistance and wind repellents. An insulating liner that traps air for warmth and offers moisture-wicking capabilities, features that promote comfort and good fit, and other features may include abrasion cut and puncture resistance. In harsh conditions, remember to always work in teams and look after each other. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. You can find our calendar on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page as well. This contains some links, and if you want the links, you can get them there. All Souls UU Forum this Sunday, 10 a.m., on Zoom, the speaker is Rose Schwab of Shawnee Mission UU Church and also active in the Kansas Poor People's Campaign. She is great to listen to. Labor Law Series, Workers' Rights in the Era of COVID, Wednesday, January 13th, 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. This is done by the University of Missouri Labor Education Program, labor law series, and you can Google that and get the link or find it on our calendar. Car Caravan, in support of $15 and a union. This is a national action. Friday, January 15th, 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Meet with your car at the Car Decoration Place, which is St. Mark's Hope and Peace Church parking lot at 3800 Troost at 10:30. Missouri Jobs with Justice preview webinar of the upcoming Missouri legislative session. Legislative session preview webinar, January 20th, 2 p.m. Go to mojwj.org/webinar to register. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called History Isn't Made by Kings and Politicians. It's made by us. This is about the Working Class History Project podcast and Milan, Missouri Rural Community Workers Alliance. Also, the Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.